I next met with Dr. Liu, again with the intent of figuring out how she approaches the initial management of ovarian cancer. But interestingly, in the interim, the FDA had now issued two new approvals. First, niraparib as maintenance therapy after chemotherapy, regardless of genomic status, and the combination of olaparib and bevacizumab in patients with BRCA germline mutations or HRD deficiency. But to begin my discussion with Dr. Liu, I repeated my first question to Dr. Moore, specifically asking her what she recommends in terms of genomic workup for the newly diagnosed patient with ovarian cancer and no significant family history.
So for somebody who presents with ovarian cancer, no family history. Optimally, I like to do germline panel testing, which is that if we think about it, BRCA1 and 2 mutations, absolutely 10 to 15% heritable mutations across the population, but also there are significant mutations outside of BRCA1 and 2, so BRIP1, RAD51CD, BARD1, PALB2, that are hereditary. And I don't want to miss those because of the potential for cascade testing and preventable disease amongst family members. Beyond that, I personally prefer panel testing within the tumor itself, so targeted next-gen sequencing, because I know that there's about a 5% rate of somatic BRCA1 or 2 mutations, and so I want to try and catch those for thinking about PARP inhibitor maintenance and guiding discussions with patients. But in addition, I think that having more information about the tumor is helpful. Recognizing that not everybody can get targeted next-gen sequencing information, I think at the minimum, you have to get germline panel testing. You have to get tumor BRCA1 and 2 mutation testing.
And am I correct in saying there are instances where a patient might have false negatives if you do NGS and if you do BRCA germline? Could you kind of explain where those come from?
Absolutely. So it's interesting because I actually recently had a patient who had a false negative tumor testing. And it has to do with what assays see and what they detect well. Some of it does have to do with different companies having different sort of thresholds for what they call a deleterious versus a non-deleterious or a VUS type mutation. But one of the things is a technical issue, which is that when we do targeted next-gen sequencing, which is how most tumor testing is done, the way the targeted next-gen sequencing is done, it may not detect moderate rearrangements, so large rearrangements or moderate-sized rearrangements. And when you actually do gene-specific testing, especially for BRCA1 and BRCA2, the way those assays have been developed, they've actually created more baits that will allow you to see rearrangements that happen, for example, in an exon. So in my particular patient's case, it turned out that she had a deletion in exon 3. So she had a deletion of exon 3 in BRCA1. And when we did her targeted next-gen sequencing, it turned out that it was not called because it could have been mistaken as an artifact because of the way those assays are interpreted. When we did her full testing and we sequenced specifically for BRCA1 and 2 and looked for mutations within that, there was a call that she had an exon 3 deletion, and we have the luxury of having an in-house next-gen sequencing platform. When I went back and spoke with our in-house folks and I said, oh, there was a call made about a deletion exon 3. Is this a real call or not? They were able to go back into our next-gen sequencing results and say, yes, we can see it, but we could not have called it because of the technical limitations of this platform.
Really interesting. So there are a couple other germline mutations that are seen, and I'm curious how you approach them.
So if they have one of these germline mutations, I bias towards giving them a PARP inhibitor. I think that with RAD51C and D mutations, I feel that the preponderance of evidence so far, with very limited numbers, suggests that those patients may have as much sensitivity to a PARP inhibitor as a patient with a BRCA1 or 2 mutation. I think that would be, you know, in terms of RAD51C and D, I feel that way about it. For PALB2 and ATM, I think the data are less clear. I don't feel that there are very strong data that say that these patients will respond to a PARP inhibitor the same way that a BRCA1 or 2 mutated tumor will. But that being said, I give these patients the benefit of a doubt because these are key players within DNA damage repair, but I am biased towards giving them the opportunity at a PARP inhibitor.
So another question I had is, I'm curious the way you were approaching genetic counseling in patients with no family history, here you're sending for these kind of genomic assays, how you approached it a few months ago and whether or not there's been any change in the way you approach it now.
Yeah, the biggest change, I think, for us, we have genetic counselors who speak with our patients. And the biggest change is that where previously our genetic counselors would come and see our patients when they were getting treatment, now they are getting separate telemedicine appointments and discussing it with our genetic counselors via telemedicine. Then they get their blood drawn when they come in for their treatment. I've actually recently also had a patient where, because of just sort of the timing of things, the genetic counselor actually sent them a saliva collection kit that they could do at home.